This is Yindyabara Talks, and here we are again in our coffee shop, wondering about the questions of love in our world, and where is the place for love? How do you find love when all love has been removed? How do you find hope where all may appear hopeless? And are those things mirages? Are love and hope false promises? All these things have been on our mind, haven't they, Jay?
They have, Stan. And look, I want to pull this back to Monday, because on Monday you delivered this really important lecture, the Don Aitkin's Memorial Lecture for 2022. And you spoke about the voice, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and the big thinkers of our world who have shaped your thinking about love and why it matters more than politics. And at the end of the conversation, someone asked you in the audience, Stan, does love matter more than politics?
Yeah.
And we were driving home on the road, weren't we, from Canberra to Sydney?
Yeah.
And you said to me, these are the moments that matter. We were listening to music.
Yes.
You said, these are the moments that matter, the moments of small intimacies, the moments of memory and love. What did you mean by that?
Because I think it's the small intimacies that rescue us from the great tragedies of the world.
Mm.
If I look at my own life and look at my family's life, you know, we spent most of my childhood moving around town to town, and my family looking for work. We were homeless. We were a black family pushed to the margins of Australia. We were the product of the great catastrophe, the invasion, the slaughter of our people, the exclusion and segregation of our people. What do we find to hold ourselves against that? And everything I needed was in that little car on a dark road, watching my mother and father in the front seat, not even speaking for miles and miles. And then my mother lighting a cigarette and passing it over to my dad right in the back of his room. Little murmurs of conversation, the warmth of my brothers and sisters around us. Those things that hold you against the world, those small intimacies, they're enough to hold at bay the great tragedy of the world.
Today we're going to be speaking with Professor Niyanti Mar about faith.
Mm.
We're going to be talking about faith's relationship, the tense relationship with democracy. What has faith taught you about love, Stan? How has it informed your thinking about democracy?
Three words. God is love. You can read the Bible from start to finish, back to front. I've spent a lifetime reading it. I was raised on it in the churches, the mission churches that I grew up in, Aboriginal churches, black churches. You can read it all. You can read endless books of theology, but there is nothing more profound or more true than those three simple words. There's the Bible. There's faith. There is all of humanity. God is love. That's all. It's not what you're commanded to do and what you're not commanded to do. It's not the man-made laws. It's not the structures of religion. It's not enormous churches with great spires and steeples. It's not grandiose mosques and temples. It's human beings and the bond of love. And you know, where there is love, for me, there is God.
Mm.
Those things are, that is irrefutable to me.
Mm.
God was in that little car. God was in the little white wooden church on the mission. The church of Satan, the people who felt abandoned. It was love that made God real for us.
So our guest on the podcast today is Professor Anthony Mar. He's the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture at Charles Sturt University. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
Anthony, we want to start by talking to you today about this ambitious project that you're currently getting up off the ground. It's the National Sacred Space at the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture that's focused on an ecumenical invitation, Indigenous heart and interfaith outreach. Could you tell our listeners about what this is and what you're hoping to achieve with it in terms of thinking about democracy?
Yes, thanks, Jack, and thanks for that question. It's something dear to my heart. Around 1924, when Lake Burley Griffin was designed and all the different areas of the National Parliamentary Triangle put in place, like the High Court, the Parliament, the National Gallery, Library, etc., they put around 6 acres aside for the National Sacred Space of Australia, like the Westminster Abbey or Washington Memorial Cathedral or the New York Cathedral or so on. And it was meant to be a huge Christian basilica called St. Mark's on the 6-acre site. And for various reasons, next year it will be 100 years, over 100 years, that national sacred site hasn't been built. And I started to believe after a period of time, and I was rather pleased that it hasn't been built, because I don't think we need another huge Christian basilica in Australia. And so the opportunity, so I took this role up in April, and it dawned on me that Australia still lives on certain myths around its identity. And there's some truths in the myths, and some of the truths are just that, just stories or fables. Or
and some myths are important, aren't they? I mean, myths are instructive.
But, myths carry truth.
Yeah.
Like the creation myths of Genesis. Yeah. But the problem is when we start to think that they're literal, or start putting weight on them that they can't hold. And there's something to do with that, with Australian identity. And so to reflect what is a national identity now, or to contribute to a national identity, we've hit on the notion of, as you said, Jack, an ecumenical invitation, which is we're there. We've been there for 100 years, so we can invite an Indigenous heart. And that's where I'm trying to reach out to Indigenous Australians to get them involved, for them to lead what this sacred space might look like. And of course, to reflect the national reality of Australia, it should also be interfaith. So something like a version of a sacred space that reflects contemporary Australia, recognizing at the heart of it what we've come to talk about today, I think, reconciliation and a robust democracy.
And, you know, you're talking about, you know, building a great monument, and you're so glad it's not there, because you actually have that sacred space, and I've been to it, right where you're located, in that wonderful, I think, the most beautiful chapel in Australia, which is an outdoor chapel around the side, facing out towards the lake, under the trees, in the shadow of the cross. It says everything. It says everything about being grounded, about being real, and about stripping away all of the artifice of faith to be confronted by the truth of it, which is where we meet, wherever we gather, there is love.
Yeah, it's done. It's a gathering place, not for one denomination. It doesn't belong to a particular faith. It belongs to the people of Australia who have a variety of faiths. And it's also a place where I think in the parliamentary triangle, just opposite the parliament, we can really gather and come to terms with some of this truth-telling, reconciliation, and forging the identity which we can all relate to, and which all Australians contribute to. So that's the plan. I'm slowly building some companions who will travel with me on this journey.
I'm really interested too, Anthony, in how do we, in the light of the weight of our history, bring people together around a shared humanity? I know in my own life where that came from. It came from the mission churches that I was brought up in, Aboriginal churches, where people who had felt the sting of Christianity and the gun that often brought it here found instead a message of love and survival and resilience and hope. How do we bring that to such troubled times that we live in, and particularly locating it in the Indigenous heart that you see at the centre of this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Snan. I heard you talking at the press club a week ago or so, and you were talking about God is hope. And in moments of despair, or when we're downcast, we might feel this sense of hope. Well, the psalmist in the scripture says that's when God is drawing near to us. So God is that hope. God is that essence, or again, noumena, which is a spirit, a wind, which moves throughout. So I think we've got to understand from the beginning what it is to be a human person. And personhood. I could get into the philosophy and the theology or the anthropology around all of that, but you probably don't want me to. But that's our common denominator, regardless of skin, color, creed, faith, location. We do have that common humanity. The Jesuit philosopher, sorry?
I was just going to, of course, as human beings, that we're anchored in traditions and contexts, right? So we come to love and we come to faith through Christianity, Islam, Hinduism. How do we get people to anchor themselves in that, you know, formative shared humanity of love without forgetting the traditions that they're actually coming to that love from?
Yeah,
because it that's where the differences are created.
The first step, if you're talking about interfaith dialogue or interfaith relations, is to know your own faith and to be secure in that faith. The second is when you engage in interfaith relations or dialogue like we're doing now, your primary intention is to learn from the other, not to teach. So you don't want to give them stuff that you know, but you actually want to get stuff from them that they know. And you recognize in your interlocutor that they have a wisdom, a tradition, a belief system that is their path to God. I was in Melbourne yesterday with some Islamic scholars who said what draws her closely to Christianity is their strong faith in God. And she says, I don't want to convert them to Islam. I just want to walk with them and respect them for their belief in God. And I reciprocated that to her. And I said, well, that's exactly the same that what we want to do in this sacred space. We don't want to convert anybody to Christianity. We want to respect and admire and learn from their tradition because they also believe God is love, as do most other of our world religions.
And yet we know, Anthony, and we see this far too often in our world, how faith can come between us and how God can command armies. You know, how people can put God in service of identity and hatred and war, and they see it as their task not to simply share and walk in the shadow of God alongside other people, but to conquer other people in the name of God. Why is it that God and faith can be so easily co-opted into hatred, and why is it so seductive for people?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, the first response there is that's not God, that's religion. The German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach had a wonderful saying. He said, man made God in his own image. And if you think about that, that's what those people do who want to use God, to like it's happening in Russia at the moment. They're using God to justify a war in Ukraine. That's not God. That's certain figures, some of them religious leaders, it's true, putting God in their own image to justify their immoral actions. So in theology, particularly if it comes out of a theology of hope, the first thing we would try and agree on is what we actually mean by God, and not to put God in a box. I'm always nervous when I hear people telling me what God thinks and what God does, and how God behaves. And I'm thinking, have they got a telephone line to heaven or something or other? And so, you know, a bit of humility, just step back a bit. Well, you can't actually say that God is justifying those sort of actions. I used to work in Northern Ireland, and I'm a Catholic, and people used to say to me, you Catholics are planting bombs in supermarkets. And my answer was, if somebody plants a bomb in a supermarket, by definition, they're not Catholic. They put themselves outside that particular faith. And so if somebody else in our world, and we know people who do, if they behave contrary to what their particular gospel or Quran or Bhagavad Gita decrees, they put themselves outside that faith. I don't kick them out or excommunicate them. They make a pretty bold statement saying, I have left that tradition. Yeah. Because the faith is not your words.
Just on that point, Anthony.
What you actually do.
Exactly. And you mentioned before the case of Ukraine. The fact is, when we're thinking about faith and love and moral principles, we're doing so in the world after the fall, if you like, in a broken world where suffering and imperfection is implicit. How does a Christian, in the case of Ukraine and Russia, forgive a Russian? How does a Ukrainian forgive a Russian for violence that is unjust being perpetuated against them? Is that something we can really call human beings on the battlefield to do?
Yeah. Well, it's a process. There's a psychological process. There's a spiritual imperative. There's also a health, personal health dimension as well. We don't forgive that bitterness or hatred is going to screw us up big time. How do you forgive? John Henry Newman would say you try and get inside the mind of the person who's taken the action against you, and you try and see where they're coming from or try and understand what they've done. I've worked with chaplains in prisons with pretty serious bad guys, and he always used to say to me, I try and see the person, not the crime. And again, that brings us back to our personal humanity. It's too easy to focus on the event and not see the person. I once, again, in Northern Ireland, a guy lost his child, and he actually forgave the bomber. And it was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. And I was involved in some of the reconciliation committees in South Africa. And when you actually see people forgive and some incredible atrocities, the liberation and the reconciliation that comes out of that is profound. So as people of faith, we're called to forgive and to reconcile for all those reasons, our own personal good for a start, but that's what we're called to do.
Anthony, I'm wondering, is there a place for the godless in all of this? Because we know, according to the latest census, that we will soon live in a majority non-religious nation. Christianity is already a minority faith in Australia, but it's not like 50% of the population. In the West, there is a crisis of faith, isn't there? It's Western liberal secularism delivers us to a point where God is almost banished, and pay a great price today for even daring to profess faith in the public square. Is there a place for people without God in your ecumenical vision of shared humanity?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Stan, but it'd take me at least 3 or 4 hours to give a half decent reply. And yet you want 30 seconds. Well, I don't think there's any such thing as people without God. I don't recognize that as a reality. We think using language, and sometimes our language doesn't give us the words or the philosophy that we want to express patterns of meaning with. Mm. So we'd have to deconstruct that your language, and maybe come to a consensus as what we think you're actually talking about. I think you might be talking about religion. I think maybe you're thinking about Nietzsche. Nietzsche was a genius, as you know. Nietzsche said, again, you referenced this, he said, God is dead. He actually said the idea of God is dead.
Yes, that's right.
And it's the idea that is struggling in
our... And challenged us to what do we feel after that? That was the big teaching of Nietzsche, is that if you kill God, then what? That was the challenge he laid down to us. And I suppose you're right in redefining those terms, but nevertheless, in a more secular world where people are not going to places of worship and saying that they don't have a faith, even if they may have it in inverted commas, a spirituality, is there a place for that in your ecumenical vision?
Yeah. Well, again, there's much in that that have to be unpacked. We can't exclude anybody. By definition, as I said, if I'm trying to be a practicing Christian, then I can't exclude anybody because that puts me outside the pale. So there's no exclusion. There has to be inclusion. And one of the things about faith in Australia, and I think, again, more generally in our thinking, there are three steps which I would recommend. Well, not me, it's a guy, a philosopher, Ignatian Alicaria, who's a philosopher of liberation. He would say something like, for example, you can't be a person of faith or you can't do theology in Australia unless you're looking at, for want of a more diplomatic term, the genocide of Indigenous people. So if I'm to do theology in Australia, I can't turn my back on that. The German theologians of the 1950s said the same, that they can't turn their back on the Holocaust. They have to turn around and face it, and they have to come to reality with it. And he gave us three steps, and this is the method I'm using in my theology. I'm trying to write a theological method for thinking about the questions you're asking me in Australia. And there are three steps that Ella Correa said. He died for this, by the way. They blew his brains out. You don't teach this and get away with it. The first thing is, and it's the hardest thing to do, and it's the first step, and Australia hasn't really begun to do it yet, is to name reality. Cold-hearted naming reality. That takes a lot of strength, a lot of courage. Number one, name reality. Here we go. Immediately see people disappear all over the place because they don't want to name reality. That takes real courage. Number two, shoulder that reality. Take the weight on your shoulder, and it's heavy. Can you really hold that weight? And number three, perhaps the hardest one of all, take responsibility for it. Do something about it. And this is the steps that I'm...
Can I add one to that as well from someone on the other side of that, as an Aboriginal person who's been carrying that burden,
yeah, to
share it and forgive.
Yeah.
Share it and forgive.
Yeah. It's the only way, Stan. It's the only way. It's the only way forward. That's why reconciliation, as you know, we've discussed this before, is a theological concept. And it's about salvation. And salvation isn't this heavenly pie in the sky, which Christianity has taught for centuries. Salvation happens now, all around us. And it takes those three steps. Mm-hmm. Name reality, shoulder the reality, take responsibility for reality. Wow. To bring, you know, we say it, Christians say it, Parliament says it in the Our Father, we say it all the time. To bring about heaven on as it is, to bring about on earth as it is in heaven. That's what our faith is about. And it's not just my Christian faith. I work closely with the leaders of all the six major faiths in Australia, and they all totally agree and get that concept. I was with the ambassador of UAE the other day at this event. The first thing he did was acknowledge the traditional landowners and pay his respects and prayed in his own way that Australia would move along the path to reconciliation. So it's happening. It's happening all around us, and people of faith are in the middle of it. Some, frankly, are at the back. Others are trying to lead. There's got to be reconciliation within Christian groups too. So this centre will try and work to bring that about.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for coming onto this podcast. I mean, I'm struck, and I think Stan is too, by your generous humility. You know, the notion that you walk to God through your own tradition and that you owe the traditions of others and their way to God a kind of generosity too is a really beautiful concept. Naming reality, shouldering reality, taking responsibility for it, and as Stan says, sharing that generously with others is the way through to love. So thank you so much for coming and speaking to us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.